In this country, there are more than 1,600 plants and animals listed as endangered or threatened. But now some states are asking the Trump administration to roll back federal habitat protections. They argue these rules will cost states and private landowners billions of dollars by blocking or delaying the use or development of their properties. Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for the Kathleen Dunn Show. This hour, we're looking into what the endangered species list has accomplished for America's most threatened plants and animals, and whether these species will have a roadmap for recovery. Joining us now is Peter Alagona. He's an associate professor of history, geography, and environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His research is on endangered species and biological diversity. Peter, welcome to the show. Well, let's start off by going over a little history of the Endangered Species Act itself. Tell us when it was passed and what it does exactly.
Sure. The Endangered Species Act, or ESA as it's oftenly called, was passed in 1973, and it was signed by Richard Nixon, Republican president. Its goal is to protect all plant and animal species and the habitats that those species depend on to survive. Most wildlife in our country is actually managed for the people under something called the public trust by the individual states. What the ESA does is it allows the federal government to work with the states to improve conservation for species that are in danger of extinction.
And given what we know about environmental conservation and animal and plant population die-offs, it took a long time to pass the legislation protecting endangered species. Why did this take so long in history?
Well, if you go back to the 19th century, the states were really the ones that were in charge of wildlife. It's still more or less that case today. But the federal government started to get involved about 75 years before the passage of the Endangered Species Act. This began with a law called the Lacey Act in 1900, and then it continued with a series of treaties and funding bills and laws aimed at protecting particular species. The ESA, which was passed in 1973, represented really kind of an effort to build on these earlier laws, but also an expansion of these earlier statutes to cover a wider range of species, and it also provided more tools to actually do conservation for plants and animals that were in danger of extinction. So it really built on three-quarters of a century of federal wildlife law in this country.
And how many species are currently on the endangered list?
Sure. So the number that's currently on the list, I actually checked this this morning, is 1,652 federally listed threatened or endangered species currently. About 700 of these, 711, are animals, and 941 are plants. There are also another 676 species that occur abroad in other countries, but are listed under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, mainly as a way for U.S. agencies to cooperate with other countries on conservation projects of mutual concern.
How much does this list fluctuate? How much of a living, breathing list is this? And who can change what is endangered and what's not?
Sure. So the ESA started, or the endangered species list, I should say, started actually before the ESA was passed in 1967, was the first list. And that list included a lot of species that listeners might recognize, charismatic animals, creatures we refer to as charismatic megafauna, big, furry, attractive animals, or economically valuable ones. And so there was a small list at the beginning, and it included animals that many of us would recognize.
Like grizzly bears? Or
Yes, absolutely.
You said furry, so I thought grizzly bear.
That's exactly right. Grizzly bears, wolves, but also creatures like gray whales, bats, other mammals, and fish. And so the list was really these iconic species, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over time, the list has grown to include more iconic species, but also a number of creatures, plants and animals, that very few of us would actually recognize, invertebrates and plants that are only endemic to certain areas. And so the list has generally grown over time, but it's grown in fits and starts. There have been periods where there have been a large number of species added to the list, And then there have been periods, such as during the George W. Bush administration, where there were very few species added and the list was relatively static over time.
Well, let's look at some of the political climate that the endangered species list is living in right now. We have these states wanting to roll back some laws that passed in the Obama administration about protected lands. What can you tell us here is with the rub with states and in the use of protected lands?
Sure. So, you know, we have to go back to that context, I think, of this being really an issue about federalism in part. So the states do manage the vast majority of wildlife within their borders, with some exceptions. Exceptions include species that migrate across state boundaries, like migratory birds. They also include species that, for example, occur on federal lands, like in national parks and national forests. And so over the history of the Endangered Species Act, there's been sort of a back and forth between many of the states and the federal government in terms of who should really be responsible for this, who should take the lead. And so what you have is you have a series of debates over time in which there have been different agreements that have been established to try to cooperate between the states and the federal government, but there's also been some friction. I should also note that some states seem to work pretty well with the federal government with regard to endangered species, and other states seem to have a bit more of an adversarial relationship. And oftentimes the states with a bit more of an adversarial relationship are those that have large areas of public land that they feel like they want to have a little bit more control over in terms of management of resources and wildlife in those areas.
For instance, Arkansas said that this is a big land grab in trying to use so much protected land for these endangered species. Is this a federal land grab?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that that's an overstatement of the issue, certainly. I do think that the federal government and the states both have important roles to play in preventing species from going extinct and trying to recover those that have declined. If you look at the way the Endangered Species Act is structured, what it really does is it says, well, you know, the states have the primary authority here, but in cases where species have declined, we're going to come in and we're going to try to work with the states and provide an extra level of protection on top of what the states provide, and do it over a period of time, hopefully leading to the recovery of that species or those species, and the removal of those species from the list. And at that point, the federal government can sort of get out of the way and allow the states to go about their normal business.
We're talking with environmental historian Peter Alagona. He's a professor at UC Santa Barbara. We're talking about the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and the complicated issues of recovering the plants and animals that get put on the list. And his recent article about this is in The Conversation. It's titled, For Endangered Species, the Road to Recovery Can Be Winding and Bumpy. Let's dig a little deeper into your title, Peter, Winding and Bumpy. What is it about recovery here for these species that isn't so clear?
Sure. So I think that the key insight here is that the Endangered Species Act tries to do two things. It tries to prevent species from going extinct, and it tries to recover species whose populations have declined to the point at which they don't need to be considered endangered anymore. Extinction is a kind of clear and concrete state of affairs. We know what extinction is.
Mm-hmm.
Recovery is harder to define. It's not really entirely clear what recovery is, and so recovery goals throughout the history of the Endangered Species Act have been established for particular species based on particular criteria that are appropriate for those species. And so we've had some successes, certainly, in the history of the ESA, but we still have a long way to go, and we've also had some failures, too. And so I would say that the record to date is pretty mixed in this regard.
What have been some of the successes in the Endangered Species Act? What do you see as its chief things that it has really done well?
Well, we can look at a few different species that have recovered under the Act and see what they've done and kind of use them as examples. So one would be the American alligator. Let's look at that one. So alligators, believe it or not, this may be something that's difficult for folks listening in the Southeast in particular to believe, but alligators' populations had declined dramatically during the 20th century to the point where they were listed initially when the Endangered Species Act was passed. By 1987, their populations had recovered to the point where they could be fully delisted from the Endangered Species Act. And I don't think anyone would look at alligators today and think that they are endangered.
Nope.
They occur widely in the Southeast, all the way from Miami to Memphis, if you can believe that. And so this is a remarkable recovery. The thing about the American alligator is that it was really driven to low numbers by one factor, and that factor was hunting. It was overhunted for its skin.
Mm.
And so in cases like that, where there's a single limiting factor that's driving a population downward, the Endangered Species Act works really well, because the government can come in and say, we're going to regulate that single limiting factor, and in many cases, species have proven resilient. Their populations have bounced back, and they've done well over time and been delisted. In some other cases, where the situation is more complex, it's been a much more difficult and, like we say in the article, a bumpy road. Let me give you one more example of a species that's recovered that folks know about, and those are bald eagles. Bald eagles declined for a variety of reasons, harassment, predator, control programs, theft of their eggs, and certainly DDT toxicity in the mid-20th century. But once those pressures were lifted, bald eagle populations rebounded, and now bald eagles are increasingly common throughout much of the United States. And so that's another example of success, but it's success in a case where there were one or two limiting factors that could be easily dealt with, as opposed to a much more complex, maybe habitat-based set of problems.
And when you say bald eagles a success, is that because we've seen them rebound across the nation? Is that because we could perhaps go see them at specific times of year nearby our homes? You know, what really is the threshold for them to be at recovered?
Yeah, this is getting at the nub of the issue now. So there are several different definitions, broad definitions of recovery. Some folks out there say that as long as a species is not in imminent danger of extinction, then it should be considered recovered. Other folks say that a species to be recovered really has to occupy a significant portion of its historic range, the range it occupied before its populations declined, maybe decades or even centuries ago. And some folks actually go so far as to say that to be recovered, a species should be not only occupying a broad swath of its historic habitat, but it should also be really at great enough numbers where it can fulfill its historic niche. So do the things in the ecosystem that really shape the system in significant ways, if it's that kind of a creature. In practice, the recovery plans under the Endangered Species Act have tended to go with a low bar. And so they've tended to focus on removing a species from imminent danger of extinction and counting that really as recovery. And I can give you an example of this. So a famous species that a lot of folks are familiar with is the California condor.
Mm-hmm.
The condor's population actually dropped to just 23 individuals by the late 1980s. All of them were in captivity. Captive breeding program was launched, and the population started to recover in captivity and then as it was reintroduced into the wild. The condor's recovery plan calls for establishing three secure populations, two wild and at least one captive, each containing at least 150 individuals and 15 breeding pairs to be downlisted from endangered to threatened. Now, that's a big mouthful, but the take-home there, in a sense, is that for the California condor, the key thing is just three self-sustaining populations.
And I hear clear, hard numbers in what you're explaining here.
Yes, yes. And so those numbers, 150 individuals with 15 breeding pairs, those are based on population viability models, computer models that take into account what we know about the species. And so it's a pretty low bar to say that we only need three secure populations in order to consider the condor recovered when that species once occurred across widely across North America.
We're talking with environmental historian Peter Alagona. He is a professor at UC Santa Barbara. We're talking about the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and the complicated issues of recovering the plants and the animals that get put on this list. His recent article about this is in The Conversation. That's an independent news outlet. It's titled, "For Endangered Species, the Road to Recovery Can Be Winding and Bumpy." And you can join in this conversation at 800-486-8655. Do you think there's adequate work being done to protect endangered species? Does this act work, and what species are you most concerned about? Join in at 800-486-8655, or you can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. But first, we're picking up our conversation now with Peter Alagona about the Endangered Species Act. He's an associate professor of history, geography, and environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's helping us understand how this act has performed over the decades in protecting plants and animals, and how scientists interpret species recovery in different ways. You can join in the conversation at 800-486-8655. That's 1-800-486-8655. What questions do you have for Peter about endangered species? What ones do you care about most? You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Peter, before we went to break, we are talking about some of the success stories through the Endangered Species Act. What have been some of the downsides of this act? What have been some of the pitfalls here?
Sure. So I would say that when folks look at the Endangered Species Act and wonder whether it's working, they look at a couple things. One of the primary things that they focus on is the relative lack of recovered species under the Act. So if you look at all of the species that have been listed, there are more than 1,600 that have been listed in the United States, plant and animal species, since 1973. And about 47 of those have been recovered since then. I should mention also that 29 of those recoveries occurred during the Obama administration, the Obama presidency. But 47 is a pretty small number, and we're looking at just a couple percent here, really, of species that have recovered since the Act was passed. And so if you say to yourself, well, the goal of the Act is to prevent extinctions and to promote recoveries, there have only been a handful of species that have gone extinct under the Act, but there also have been a very small number of species that have actually recovered. And so when people look at this, they say the Act is doing a pretty good job at preventing extinctions, but it hasn't really fulfilled its goals, at least yet, in terms of recovering listed species and moving them off the list.
And like everything in life, politics comes into play. Critics often assert that the Act creates onerous regulations that hinder development without saving many species. What are some of the political issues at play here, and have researchers examined the cost-benefit of saving species?
So I think that the ESA, unfortunately, has become a little bit of a Rorschach test these days. Folks who don't really like the idea tend to think it's not working very well, and folks who do like the idea tend to think that the Act is succeeding. I think the truth, if you kind of look at all the evidence in the way that I like to do, is that the story is really pretty mixed to date. But certainly the main criticisms are this problem of lack of recoveries. And then the second one is that it costs too much. And I think we can talk about each of those in turn. Folks who talk about the lack of recoveries, I think, are right in a sense that much more could be done to try to bring back some of the species that are on the list. I think that part of that is a lack of resources, and part of it is a lack of time. In some cases, these creatures that are on the list took decades to decline, and it may take decades to bring them back. And so a little bit of patience in that regard, I think, would be really helpful.
What species in particular are we talking about here that may have a very long road to recovery?
Right. It's actually a lot of them, but I can give you a couple of examples that you might know. One up in the Northern Rockies is grizzly bears. Grizzly bears have done really well over the past couple decades in Yellowstone, in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and there have actually been efforts to delist or declare recovered the Yellowstone population of grizzlies. But throughout the rest of the northern Rockies and northern Cascades, where grizzlies occur today in the lower 48 U.S. states, their populations are not yet at the point where they can be considered recovered. And I think that folks up there tend to think that they still have quite a ways to go. Another one that folks may have heard of is the northern spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest. That was the source of quite a lot of debate in the late 1980s and early 1990s about conservation versus use of the Northwest forest for timber resources. Spotted owls have continued to decline in some areas. In some areas, their populations have stabilized. But the situation there is quite complex, and I think most folks agree that it will be a very long time until we can consider spotted owls recovered under the Endangered Species Act.
Well, going back to grizzly bears, you wrote in your piece that they thrive in greater Yellowstone ecosystem. How big a role do national and state parks play here?
So I think that public lands in general play a crucial role, in part because these are areas that still have a lot of habitat and have the potential for a lot of habitat restoration. And there are also areas, at least with regard to some of our land management agencies, where conserving and recovering endangered species is a real priority. And so if you look at the National Park Service, for example, the Park Service takes this issue very seriously and does a lot of work toward trying to recover endangered species. On the other side, though, I think that most conservationists, conservation biologists who look at the situation today think that public lands are important, but they're not a panacea. In other words, public lands can provide core reserves and habitat areas for many endangered species, but for species to really recover, for many of them, it will require not only public lands, but also private lands involving conservation partnerships and efforts to create situations in which people can coexist with endangered species instead of just having to lock them up in parks where they may or may not have enough space to grow and succeed.
Through time, has there been an expansion of land devoted to protecting and restoring endangered species?
Yeah, there has. And this has happened in a variety of different ways. Some national parks, for example, have at the core of their establishment the protection of endangered species. For example, in Hawaii volcanoes, or in Florida, the Florida Everglades. All important areas for endangered species, really from the very beginning, dating to well before the establishment of the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service also runs a large network of national wildlife refuges, which do a lot of really important work on behalf of endangered species. The states do some work in terms of managing land in this way and other federal agencies. And there are also non-governmental organizations like the Nature Conservancy that play really important roles in working with land management agencies, but also in purchasing and managing their own lands and cooperating with nearby landowners to try to recover endangered species and restore and improve habitat as well.
Let's take a call now at 1-800-486-8655. Let's go to Laura in New Berlin. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Kate and guest, and thank you for having this discussion. I think it's perhaps the most critical issue of our time, and on that point, I'm sure the speaker is aware of E.O. Wilson, who has written on this topic just last year a book called Half Earth, where he proposes setting aside half of the Earth's surface, both land and sea, for the natural world. Otherwise, he believes during the 21st century, most species could be lost, largely due to habitat loss, which is ultimately driven by human overpopulation. All this, let's say, loss of the critical rainforest, the Amazon, for growing often crops to feed cattle like soy.
Oh, I think we might have lost you there for a moment, Laura. Peter, do you have any reaction to this?
Yeah, well, if you look at the global conservation estate, or the lands that are dedicated to conservation worldwide, I think we're now at something like 10 or 11% of the global land area, depending on how you count it, that's dedicated to some form of conservation for biodiversity, endangered species, wildlife, ecosystem services like clean water and things like that. And those are all really important, and I think that we clearly need a lot more protected areas. I think they provide a huge amount of social benefits. Those benefits accrue to people at large, and I think that we would be better off with a lot more of them. Having said that, I do also think that it's important to remember that we will never have enough protected land to conserve all of the Earth's biodiversity. And so this means that we also need to be able to live with other species. Let me give you a quick example of this. In the United States right now, going back to the grizzly question, there are about somewhere below 2,000, maybe 1,800 or so grizzlies, which are called brown bears in the rest of the world, in the lower 48 U.S. states. The lower 48 U.S. states is significantly bigger than the EU and has a significantly smaller human population. It also has a lot of protected wilderness areas, which they don't have in the EU. But in the EU, they have something like 10 times the number of brown bears. They have something like 17,000 instead of 1,700 or 1,800. And so there's a very different history. There's a different situation, different politics, different set of relationships with these animals there. But one thing this does tell me is that there are possibilities for different models for how to live with creatures that may be endangered in certain areas. Even some of the ones that seem the biggest and the toothiest, we might be able to accommodate in the future if we think differently about living with wildlife instead of just, like I said before, locking them up in protected areas. Protected areas are important, but they're not a panacea.
Well, what you're saying, too, is that because we won't be able to save everything, that there will be some choices, some decisions that have to be made, that saving has something to do with selectivity. Is that right?
Well, certainly, if you look at the way conservation organizations have approached their work over the last several decades, they've all tried to prioritize areas to protect based on the species that live there, based on the amount of biodiversity, based on the value of those areas for conservation in a lot of different ways. I think that's been going on for a long time. I think that in the future we may encounter more of those choices. Some of them will be limited by financial resources. Some of them will be limited by available land. I think others, unfortunately, will probably be limited by the very meager resources, the meager budgets that many of these organizations, public and private, have to actually do conservation.
We're talking right now with environmental historian Peter Alagona. He's a professor at UC Santa Barbara. He studies the Endangered Species Act of 1973 that we're talking about right now. You can join in this conversation at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. What questions do you have for Peter about the recovery of specific species that you're concerned with today? Join in the discussion at 800-486-8655. Let's go now to Julie in Cottage Grove. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I was just concerned about what happens, like in the case of the California condor, to the gene pool when they're self-gene individuals, and if you does it result in mutations or birth defects?
She's talking about gene pool and whether there's an impact on birth defects and some changes, perhaps, to the gene pool.
That's a great question, and it's a question that conservationists encounter whenever they're dealing with small populations in the wild, in captivity, and elsewhere. And so I think that we've actually come a long way in terms of understanding the genetics of small populations. There's an organization in my home state here in California based at the San Diego Zoo that focuses entirely on these questions of conservation genetics and how to make sure, or do the best that we can at least, in ensuring that small populations have the best chance of survival even in relatively small gene pools. It turns out that some species are way more tolerant of having a homogeneous and small genetic pool than others, and that's something that we're really just learning about now. Others are less tolerant, and in those cases, we need to do everything we can to try to reinvigorate the gene pool in ways that can increase their viability. One example of this has to do with the Florida panther, which is a subspecies of mountain lion that lives only in Florida. Its population, many of your listeners might know, Kate, its population declined dramatically and was at the point really of genetic death, downward spiral, because deleterious genetic traits, recessive traits were showing up. And the decision was finally made to bring in mountain lions from another part of the country, from Texas, to try to reinvigorate that population. It's not a pure Florida panther population, if it ever was, certainly with these animals from other areas, but they've had significant success in reducing the occurrence of some of these damaging traits. And the Florida panther, that population now has much more of a chance of surviving than it did, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so I think that's good news.
But is it a pure Florida panther, or is because introducing different facets of the gene pool, do you skew the Florida panther in any way here? I'm not talking scientifically, obviously, but you can kind of see what I'm saying.
Well, by saying you're not talking scientifically, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think that this is in part a judgment call and in part a call about what we value. Do we value purity, some idea of genetic purity? It's not clear that the Florida panther was ever really genetically pure in any way. And that idea of genetic purity strikes me as being problematic in a lot of ways. Or do you value having a healthy population of these animals living in their historic range? For me, I feel personally a bit like I value the idea of genetic purity quite a bit less, and I value the idea of having healthy populations of animals occupying their historic range quite a bit more. But these are tough conversations and conversations that will continue to unfold with regard to many species who are at the point where they have very low populations today.
How big a role do some of our state and federal agencies have in all of this? Here in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker has made cuts to the Department of Natural Resources budget. How do these cuts impact the effectiveness of the work that's being done to save endangered animals on the state front? But also when you look on the federal level, cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, how will that impact, those cuts impact the Endangered Species Act?
So I think to answer this question, at first you just have to realize that these agencies have always been strapped for resources. They've always had meager funding, and they've done a lot of really amazing work given the resources that they have over time. In my view, I think that the Walker administration's moves and the moves that the Trump administration is proposing are almost precisely wrong. And the reason I say that is that if you really want to get endangered species off the list, if you want to not have to worry about them as endangered species, the best way to do that is to invest a little bit more money in their recovery, to get them to a place where we don't need to worry about them so much, where they have self-sustaining populations, where they have places that they can call home. And that would benefit everybody, I think, in a way that would actually create more certainty and more opportunities for economic development in other adjoining areas.
But when there's such competition for these dollars, for the money, our species up against so many other things that are dominating for these precious dollars.
So just to put this in perspective, I have the 2016 Fish and Wildlife Service budget in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a variety of different ways to count this. A variety of different agencies at the federal and state level all contribute to endangered species conservation. And there's a lot of money that comes in through non-governmental organizations and private foundations as well. But in the 2016 Fish and Wildlife Service endangered species budget, spending that actually goes specifically toward endangered species, the number I'm looking at here is $170 million. $170 million. A single F-22 fighter plane costs about $355 million. And so I'm not meaning to create a false comparison with the importance of military spending, but what I am saying is that we've really failed to invest adequately in programs that benefit society in myriad ways. I think we could do that. I think we could spend a little bit more, and I think it would go a long way because these agencies are already used to doing a lot with the modest resources that they have.
We're talking right now with environmental historian Peter Alagona. He's a professor at UC Santa Barbara, where his research focuses on endangered species and their history. His recent article in The Conversation talks about how the Endangered Species Act of 1973 doesn't give all species a clear roadmap to recovery, and the species can get caught up in the politics of the day. You can join this conversation at 800-486-8655. Do you think enough is being done to protect endangered species? What questions do you have for Peter? And what specific species are you worried about today that you want to see take a stand on? Join in at 800-486-8655. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Peter Alagona about the Endangered Species Act of 1973. He's an environmental historian at University of California, Santa Barbara, and he studies the recovery patterns for endangered species over time. Recently, more than a dozen states want to roll back protections, expanding the definitions of what are protected habitats for the species on the list. What species are you most concerned about? What do you think about the rollback of such protections? Join in at 800-486-8655. And let's now go to the phones with Marco in Stevens Point. Hi, Marco.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to bring up kind of the economic value of conserving wildlife. I think that the public view on wildlife is often just kind of... if it's being conserved, there's often not much of a reason behind it. But actually, the wildlife industry and, like, the recreation industries that feed off wildlife are huge. And not just hunting, but wildlife watching, which is a lot of bird watching and whale watching. That's the second biggest outdoor recreation industry next to gardening. So there really can be a huge benefit economically from conserving wildlife besides just having other animals that have a place to live. I just wanted to throw that into the ring.
Peter?
Marco is exactly right, and the benefits come from a wide variety of quarters. Hunting and fishing, certainly, wildlife viewing, bird watching, tourism, backyard bird feeding, all of this stuff, folks would be surprised to learn how much money people are spending on these activities. And people are doing that because they want to connect with wildlife. You know, if you look at the rationale behind preserving species, there are really two main justifications. One is that other species have an intrinsic value. They have a value unto themselves that has nothing to do with humans, and that means that they have a certain right to exist. But the other justification is a utilitarian value. And the utilitarian value says that they have myriad values to people, to human beings, in all sorts of ways, whether through science or through economics or through any variety of other pathways. And so folks often underestimate this. I think Marco is exactly right. And I think that this is something that we should remember to focus on when we're talking about legislation that would potentially roll back protections.
Marco, thanks so much for your call. Let's now go to Sigourney in Green Bay. Hi, Sigourney.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My question was... actually about the wolf populations. Being from Wisconsin, there's been a lot of back and forth. They were on the endangered species list, and now they've instigated hunting seasons for wolves, which upsets me because they only just started making a comeback, I feel. And, I mean, what sort of politics goes into that? Why, like, who makes these decisions, and like, who are they asking? Like, they feel as though they should be asking academics and professors, or at least somebody with more compassion to tackle these issues. And I feel like it's been very neglected. And you're entirely right, your comment before about just needing to spend a little bit more on species preservation and getting them to a good place so that they're self-sustaining. But yeah, what's going on with our politics?
Peter.
So to talk about a little bit about the wolf issue in a broad sense, and thank you so much for the question. This is an issue of perennial interest to folks because wolves are really captivating to folks from across the political spectrum in this country. Wolves were mostly extinct from much of the lower 48 states, with the exception of the upper Midwest and a little small part of the Southeast, and a hybrid breed, until the mid-1990s. And at that time, the Fish and Wildlife Service was working with state agencies to bring back the wolves. They were brought back to the Northern Rockies, and then they came in through Canada. And in the years since then, wolf populations in several areas have really increased considerably. Wolves have proven to be a remarkably versatile, adaptable, tolerant, resilient species. And they're everywhere. As a matter of fact, we now have wolves in California, in my home state, for the first time in at least 80 or 90 years, as of a few years ago. And so I think that the question then becomes, at what point does the federal government step back and allow the states to come in? To do this, what the Endangered Species Act really requires, and what federal law in general requires, is that the states have a viable, well-written management plan that will prevent the population of wolves in their states from once again becoming endangered and having to be relisted. And so this has been an issue that has unfolded in several parts of the country. It relates back to the federalism question of who should have authority and under what circumstances. And we've seen it go down in different ways in different states, in Montana, in Idaho, in Wyoming, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, now in Oregon and California. And so I think what you should expect to see is the various states working hard to try to make the case that they have a plan and that they are indeed capable of preserving wolf populations in a viable, long-term way, and that the federal government should relinquish control to them. And part of that management plan at the state level often involves some degree of hunting.
Well, Sigourney, thank you so much for addressing the wolves with your question. Let's take another call now at 800-486-8655. We'll go to Lee now in Madison. Hi, Lee.
Hello. Thank you. First, I want to thank the team of the Kathleen Dunn Show and their guests for addressing this vital topic, even with the press of other current events. Really appreciate it. My question is there any flexibility under the Endangered Species Act to account for the study of the impacts of climate change on endangered species and to account for that in the management of the species? And could you comment generally on the considerations of climate change in the management of threatened and endangered species?
Great question. Thank you so much. In many ways, this is really the elephant in the room. Climate change is going to affect every aspect and is, in fact, already affecting every aspect of the ecosystems in which we live and that we share with other species. That is unavoidable. It's underway right now. And folks are just trying to wrap their minds around how this is all going to pan out. What I would say with regard to endangered species is that there are species for whom the impacts will be direct and clear. And then there are species for whom the impacts will be indirect, less clear, and a little bit harder to understand. So let me give you an example here. So the pika, some of you may be familiar with the pika. It's a little creature. It looks like a little gerbil. It's actually related to rabbits and hares. It lives in mountains in the American West, all across the West, on high mountaintops. And an interesting thing about the pika is that it's an adorable little creature. People love them. But they seem to be very intolerant of elevated temperatures. They like it really cool out. And so they have a direct vulnerability to the possibility of increased temperatures in these areas as climate changes in the American West. And so the pika is a creature that certainly has increased vulnerability and that the impacts are potentially quite direct. But there are many other species for which the impacts are indirect, species for which an elevated climate or changes in precipitation may affect their ability to breed successfully, or the ability of their young to reach maturity, or the numbers of their prey, which could in fact affect their populations over time. And so this is an incredibly complex equation. The federal government, to a certain extent, but also certainly universities and other institutions, are dedicating a tremendous amount of resources to this, but we're really just scratching the surface. I think what we can say is that whereas a decade or so ago, we were focusing mainly on models of what might happen in the future under various climate scenarios, we still have those models today, but now we're actually observing these things in the field. And so that's a significant difference in the kind of science that's being done and in the kind of things that we're learning.
Lee, thanks so much for your question on climate change's impact to endangered species. Let's now go to Gary in Boscobel. Hi, Gary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm involved with an organization here in Wisconsin called the Prairie Enthusiasts. And our goal is to find, purchase, and restore the tiny scraps of tall grass prairie that are left in the upper Midwest. We have about 1,500 members in our organization and chapters in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And we've to date saved over 3,000 acres of scraps of prairie and protect hundreds of species of threatened and endangered animals, microorganisms, insects, and birds. And one of our problems is getting enough younger volunteers to participate in this huge task. Most of us that are involved are in our late 50s, early 60s, and even into our 70s. So the awesome responsibility of trying to preserve our biodiversity is an honorable thing that we feel we're doing, but it's also a tremendous task, and we can use all the help we can get. We do have a website, too. It's prairieenthusiast.org if anybody would be interested in checking it out.
Gary, thanks so much for your call and giving us a sense of what the prairie enthusiasts are up to in Wisconsin. And Peter, why should we care so much about the Endangered Species Act?
So I think that the key thing that I would say is that, you know, the Endangered Species Act is sort of a stopgap. It's the last thing that we have to prevent species from disappearing from the face of the earth. And you know what? If one or two invertebrates or endemic plants disappears, then most people wouldn't know. But as we start to chip away at the ecosystems that we have, that we've inherited from people before us, and that we've been given in a way to manage and to steward, as we start to chip away at those things, then eventually systems that we depend on and that we enjoy and that we need will start to degrade and fall apart. And so I think that the Endangered Species Act, although it focuses on individual species, the idea is really a broader attempt to preserve biological diversity, the diversity that we all depend on to survive, in the exact way that Gary is talking about, by preserving the tall grass prairie in Wisconsin. But you know what, Kate, if there's one thing that I could really leave your listeners with about the Endangered Species Act and about what we can do with it in the future, it's that the best thing we can do with the Endangered Species Act is to prevent species from getting on it in the first place. And the way we do that is to develop more proactive programs like Gary's program, like other programs, that seek to preserve biological diversity and native species and get communities involved and invested before we get to the point of having a biological and political and economic fiasco, train wreck of a listing of a species that can be disruptive to those communities. And so, for example, in 2015, an enormous effort was undertaken. Groups got together, and they developed a plan to preserve the sage grouse on large portions of prairie in the American West and in the Intermountain West. And so this effort went forward, and it was ultimately approved by the Fish and Wildlife Service without allowing the sage grouse to get on the endangered species list, where it would have invoked new regulations and new restrictions. And so that seems to me to be a great example of the kind of thing that we can do in the future to protect endangered species and the ESA, which is to do proactive work and keep these creatures healthy and safe and prevent them from becoming endangered to begin with.
Peter, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
You're You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Peter Elagona is an associate professor of history, geography, and environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His recent article is titled, "For Endangered Species, the Road to Recovery Can Be Winding and Bumpy," and we've shared a link to it over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we talk with the author of the new book, Hashtag Republic, Divided Democracy in the Age of Social Media. It's a deep dive into how the internet is presenting new challenges to American democracy. Hope you can join us for that discussion. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show and Colleen Duval for on-air production help today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.